A stranger with a gun came upon two teens taking pictures under a rising full moon. But violence is only the beginning of this story.
Sometimes I thought, there are no miracles. Yeah, there are, and this is a big one.
I'm Amy Donaldson, and I've spent my career talking about how lives are undone by violence. The Letter is a podcast about how lives are remade. Follow The Letter at theletterpodcast.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Voices of Reason. I'm Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson.
Hello.
And today...
Happy Valentine's Day, by the way.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Let's bring in some love right off the bat.
Today, we're going to be talking about historical contributions of African Americans, and we are honored to have Reverend France Davis with us today, along with Adrian Andrews, who is the Assistant Vice President for Diversity at Weber State University, as well as the Chief Diversity Officer, and my friend, who also served with me on the... she was, at the time, the chairman of the chairperson of the MLK Commission.
I was just an active committee member.
I don't know. I think you were leading the meeting, so I feel like that was... I want to keep using that. So, Reverend Davis you've been the pastor for Calvary Baptist Church for how long?
I was the pastor for some 46-plus years.
You retired, what, four months ago?
December 29th. December.
Oh, it hasn't been. It feels like 4 months.
What you were just telling me, though, it's not really retirement, right?
No, retirement is not all that people suggest. It means no work, but it means more work. Now it's work that you choose to do as opposed to work that you have to do.
I got you. Well, I know I've chatted with you before when Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2009. You and I had a discussion afterwards because I was covering the inauguration in Washington, D.C. And when you were a younger man, you actually participated in the March on Washington.
I did.
And so can you talk to me about what you think when you think of Black History Month specifically, but the contributions of African Americans throughout our history, what do you feel like society thinks of when they think of that?
Well, when Black History started, it started as a week, and it was started in the early 1900s, and designed to emphasize the positive achievements that African Americans have made to this country. We were a part of the building of America from day one, and as a part of that, we're oftentimes left out or ignored in terms of the history books. So what was intended with the initial week and later on in the 50s becoming a month was to have Black history be included for African Americans just as any other history. My goal, and I think the goal today, is to have Black history integrated into all of the history, all of the textbooks, everything that's happening where African Americans have participated.
Which I think is really important for people like me. I have something to share a little bit later about Reverend Davis at all. Maybe the last segment. So, because you were a great help to a young reporter. I was here very young, and I wanted to write about what was then called minority issues. and I think they were minority issues because they just weren't. We didn't have a lot of people of color in the newsroom. We still don't, and we didn't have. We didn't see them as sources for everyday stories. So when you looked at getting a doctor, a quote from a doctor, you probably went to a doctor that you knew or that looked like you. And so when everyone's white and that's our experience, those were the voices of authority in the media. And so I think the integration, I just was exposed I had a great high school teacher to Maya Angelou, and Toni Morrison became my favorite author at a young age. And it did change the way I think that I saw things, but it didn't change my socialization. And so where I had a sensitivity, but I didn't have that sort of integrated idea, and it was really having people help me with story ideas that I started seeing all these authorities out there that we just in the media ignored. And I think if we were teaching history as inclusive, like all of the different authorities that are out there, it wouldn't be I'm guilty of it. I did a whole package on who were the black first in Utah, which honestly was probably a good story for me to do because it got me into the black community and it let me know that their roots are as deep as any of the pioneers.
Well, in fact, African Americans were in Utah 20 years before those who are considered the pioneers that settled the community. Yeah. James Beckwith and others were here doing fur trapping in the 1820s. Mm-hmm. And everybody thinks about the 1840s, but nobody thinks about the 1820s when African Americans were actually already here.
Adrian, you, as a person who understands kind of the academic part of this, the way you explain it is that it's those who write the history get to tell it?
That's correct. And they also get to determine what counts as history and what gets excluded. And so when we think about what we learn in our K through 12 system, as well as in our higher ed or continuing ed opportunities, what we learn is largely shaped by what the people who are teaching us know and what they were taught. And so, as Amy said, if you weren't taught to see the world in its complexity, then you are not able to understand and teach others that complexity. And I, of course, was very fortunate in that Reverend Davis was Dr. Davis for me at the University of Utah when I was an undergrad, and I took the African American experience from him as a student. I ended up minoring in ethnic studies with a focus on African American studies because of that class and because of the fact that I grew up here in Utah as one of a very limited number of people who identified as black in my community. And if it weren't for people in my family and that were connected to me who shared other black leaders, inventors, creators, writers, doers, activists, I wouldn't have known because the schools weren't giving me that content. And we still have that battle today with textbooks coming out of California and Texas in particular about how black history gets framed, whether or not it's talked about as slavery or guest workers, or whether or not the first immigration program was slavery. These are very interesting ways to reframe a history that is painful and dark and that we must directly own and address and figure out how we want to reshape our movements forward and make sure that we tell the story, the real, true story of American history, which is black history.
We set this up, though, from the start with the Constitution of the United States defining some people as whole people, others as no people, and others as three-fifths of a person. And ever since that day, we've been having to try to bring some kind of equality and fairness about all of the peoples of our respective communities. That's for the country as a whole, as well as for the state.
When we come back, what I want to do is talk about any specifics. I want to go back to a story that I can tell from my childhood, having grown up in Chicago, and kind of my first learnings of what was then African-American history and how it helped me be more intellectually curious about American history, especially as it related to African-Americans' contributions to it. You're listening to Voices of Reason.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLPodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome back to Voices of Reason. I am Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. Today, we're speaking about contributions of African Americans and in our American history as it relates to Black History Month. Joining us today, a local, civil rights and historian and just an icon in our community, Reverend Frantz Davis, along with Adrian Andrews, who is Assistant Vice President for Diversity at Weber State University, as well as their Chief Diversity Officer. And I wanted to relate a story to you. So when I was growing up in Chicago, I learned a fair amount about Black history. But one of the things, my parents, we had two sets of encyclopedia, and all kinds of other things. My mother's a kind of a voracious reader, and though I didn't necessarily inherit that from her, I did learn a lot by having those resources at my availability whenever I wanted. So we were asked to do, and I want to say this was like, I don't know, third, fourth grade or something like that, kind of a book report on somebody from Black history. And what I didn't want to do was choose, like, you know, the usual suspects, right? So, which was back then George Washington Carver or Martin Luther King Jr. And so what I chose was a fellow named William Steele, and I'm trying to find out more information about him, but I remember he was an abolitionist. So, like, to me, that was my first foray into learning more about my own culture, my own history. And it helped me give me this intellectual curiosity to learn more rather than what was kind of what was being taught to me. This is my ability to get more information for myself, enrich my own understanding of myself and, you know, the people who came before me. And I think, fortunately for me, I had that support at home and to a large degree from my teachers at school, because we had a lot of African-American educators in my school. And so they kind of helped, encourage that kind of learning from us. But we don't not everybody is as fortunate as I've been. So in that way, I want to ask you, Adrian, so how is it that from an academic point of view, certainly, how do you get more kids to understand what has happened and the connection between African-Americans' contribution to American history?
Well, that's by being inclusive in your educational practices, no matter what they are. It doesn't matter if you're teaching in science or engineering or English or creative writing or history. You're bringing in multiple narratives and perspectives and histories and documentation that comes in many formats. What that requires is that educators actually engage in a critical pedagogy that says there are multiple narratives that create the history from the past, not the singular narrative that is how we lived. Because as Reverend Davis said, you know, who shaped what counted began at the founding of this nation. And the reality that Black men were counted as three-fifths of a person is directly indicative of property rights. That's not about wanting them to be able to vote or have rights. It's allowing the property owner to have additional rights as a owner and able to vote and be engaged in the political system. So leveraging us as property versus recognizing our humanity as African Americans or slaves, coming to this, being stolen and brought to this country because we didn't come here of our own volition, that makes a difference. And so until we talk about who gets to shape the knowledge, how it gets to be defined, who gets included in those conversations and excluded is critical. And we see that in our everyday experiences. When we think about the sort of the American West and we think about cowboys, we don't think about the fact that one in four cowboys were African American, but they were. In all of the stories that get told in the media, what do you see? Not Black cowboys, right? And yet we know that that is actually true.
Is that, I heard some, this could be a folklore, but isn't that why they call them boys?
That I do not know.
No, just wondering.
But the Black cowboys were everywhere doing this work and integrating the American West. And yet that's not included in our history.
Let me give you a horrifying example of that from my own racially small experience, I would say. I grew up in Alaska.
Limited.
I grew up in Alaska. Mm-hmm. And so most of the people of color I knew were, I knew one African-American human being until I came to college in Utah. So I went from Alaska to Utah. So there you go. There's my experience. But so what I knew mostly was through books. But I was covering rodeo in my early days, and I ran into Fred Whitfield, who's a world champion roper, one of the best there is. And I think he was sort of early in his career when I first
started. No, I know who you're talking about. So I was like, wow.
So I'd never seen a Black roper. And so I went up to him and I said, hey, I'm a reporter here in Salt Lake. I wonder if I could do a story on you. And he said, yeah, why are you asking me? And I said, because I've never seen a Black roper. And he said, I'll do it with you because you're the first person to tell me the truth. But I said, I just want to know how you got into this. And he told me about it. He wasn't living on a ranch or a farm, and he had friends who were into rodeo, and he wasn't into traditional sports. But it's really the first time I thought about how much my interests were shaped by my socialization and by stereotypes, right? So I thought that was, and I do it, I have done it throughout my career, and people have been very kind to me, but it has also, one of the reasons I love this job is you can learn if you want to, and you can help other people learn. And I mean, and this man sitting right next to me, Reverend Davis, was one of the best teachers I had.
So Reverend Davis, when you hear this kind of thing, I mean, having kind of experienced this from a longer point of view than we have, how do you, for people like us, how do you learn to accept the way things are but still want to be able to affect some kind of positive change?
Well, I think you appreciate what is, but you also pursue what has not yet been achieved. And I think that all of us have the responsibility to get to know people different than ourselves and realize that they are human beings, that they are just like us in many ways, different in some ways, but in other ways very much the same. And unfortunately, when we write our history books, oftentimes we leave out anybody other than those who are like us, as Adrian has been saying.
And we kind of look at those people like us as the ones that probably have done the most. I always feel like when we seldom recognize people who are foreigners, even let alone you know, if they're not American, their contributions to the world themselves. By the way, I want to mention, so it was William. I knew there was something different about this fellow. It's actually William Still, like Still, and he was the person who actually coined the Underground Railroad. And so, I mean, those are kinds of things when you're young and you're able to learn stuff like that. There's something in me that just feels better realizing that I just learned something that most people don't know, but is truly important in the way we grew up. But
he was also quite a musician, William Still, and much of the music that we claim historically, William Still was the one who put it down on a piece of paper so that we'd have it in 2020.
Excellent.
And that's about representation. When you don't see people who look different from yourselves, then what is possible in the world becomes very limited to the people who do look like you. Or conversely, it may look like people who look like you don't ever contribute anything because you don't ever see them in leadership roles or in the history texts or in film or media. And so representation matters, which is also why it's critical that our classroom spaces be inclusive in the information that is shared and taught, so that what is possible is also recognized as what has happened. Because who created the first stoplight system?
Garrett A. Morgan.
There you go. But how many people know that Garrett A. Morgan is an African-American man?
Probably very. And he also, the gas mask, too, by the way.
Right.
Yeah.
But people don't know that. People don't know that every time I stop at a stoplight, I think about the fact that this is an invention from somebody who looked like me. Yeah. And I don't get to walk around all day, every day, knowing that because we don't share the history or the knowledge of these pieces, whether it's somebody who identifies as African American, Hispanic, Latinx, Asian, Pan-Asian, Native. It makes a difference because suddenly we see ourselves as part of the fabric of the nation, the fabric of the culture that has come before us and that will guide us into our next steps.
When we come back, I want to continue the discussion on some of those contributions, if we can actually come up with a few of those, just to let people know and get kind of whet their appetites as to what can be learned and what can be understood about the growth of America and the contributions of African Americans to it. You're listening to Voices of Reason. We are back with Voices of Reason. I am Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. Today we're with Reverend France Davis, who is just a local historian and a person that everybody in this room admires just a great deal here in Salt Lake City, who's a former pastor of the Calvary Baptist Church, and also Adrian Andrews, Chief Diversity Officer and Assistant Vice President for Diversity at Weber State University. Amy actually had a notion regarding how she came to understand more about contributions from African Americans.
I definitely believe that the educational component is the key to changing things, because it doesn't just impact like what we know and you know who gets quoted in a newspaper article or whatever. It impacts who we admire and who we aspire to be and who we hold out as a virtuous or, you know, a person that when we throw up a quote, you know, I mean, and there's more than just like a couple quotes, right? Like I told you, every day now I've been reading a Nelson Mandela quote because I find his perspective really helpful to me when I'm discouraged, when I am, you know, really in a dark place. But I am Toni Morrison is... I was telling Jason, I have audiobooks. I was just recently re-listening to her read her books. And I re-listened to Maya Angelou's autobiography because I feel like it's a pep talk in a way of resilience. And I don't know. I have worked 20 years in sports and I've spent a lot of time being the only woman in the room. And I still don't feel like I understand what it's like to be culturally the only person in the room, right?
Well, it's interesting that you bring up Nelson Mandela. I was just in South Africa 2 weeks ago and went to the place where he was jailed, where Gandhi was also in jail. Mm-hmm. And yet, when we think about people in America, in the United States of America, we don't even think of those kind of names except the name of Martin Luther King and a few others that I highlight. One of the things I think that we need to encourage people to do is to read the books of Gwendolyn Brooks, of Toni Morrison, of Margaret Walker, of Maya Angelou. I think we also ought to take a look at the local people mm-hmm. like Alberta Henry, people like Fannie Jackson, mm-hmm. People like Mignon Richmond, Sandra Hollins, and the kind of things that are happening to her. Currently, demonstrate how little we know and believe or respect those who are different than we are.
And I think I just had a conversation with a family member recently about the Confederate monument issue, right? I think what we know impacts how we view political issues, right? And I said, name for me, you believe these statues should remain because they're just monuments to these soldiers and what they and just their love of country, which I see is not the case. But I said, then name me one memorial to slaves, to what we did to every African-American person and their descendants that live in this country. Name me one. And he said, well, there's got to be one, but there's not that there's none. Right. And I said, that's one of the things that struck me. It was when I went to Tanzania and saw, you know, the square where they sold people and the places. I told Jason, it's changed my life. And I saw memorials to that horrific thing that we as human beings did. Right. Mostly white people, but also, you know, in other countries, other people did it. But it was mostly black people who were the Africans who were the victims of this, right?
Well, and that's owning the history. That's saying this is part of our past. This is what we've done, and this is why we will never do it again. And that's why Holocaust remembrance is so powerful, because this is a religious group of individuals who've been able to rally the world behind them around their history, around the genocide, to say this is not acceptable and should never happen again. And we recognize every year during Holocaust remembrance, what happened, why it happened, how it began, and we can see...
And the horrors of it. Me, how many movies, how many books, how many... I went to the Holocaust Museum. I spent 7 hours there.
And you could easily spend...
Every single horror.
You could spend days.
There's not a museum. There's not a monument like that. Now, there is the newly opened in 2017 to the lynching memorial, mm-hmm. which Jason knows I'm like constantly trying to finagle a way for us to go there. But yeah. But I will go there, but I want to be able to spend 7 hours somewhere like I did at Pearl Harbor, immersing myself in the reality of what happened, not just some superficial,
other component of this is people think about slavery and they think that's 400 years ago. That's a lifetime ago. That wasn't my fault. That wasn't me. And that's sort of people can have that frame. It is a scapegoat. Instead, say, slavery happened. This is what we did. Why did we do it? What were our arguments for it? Suddenly, we can start to deconstruct what we did then versus who we are today, mm-hmm. what we believe now, and what we are willing to do.
And this is where I'll plug the Uncivil podcast, which is a podcast that takes a look at the Civil War and how the tentacles of that reach to today in banking, in real estate, mm-hmm. in our military, in our education system. There is not a system of government in this country that was not impacted negatively by slavery.
And that's what reparations are all about. Reparations are about trying to figure out how to make those connections between the way people were treated because they were African American and the economic development that has occurred in our country. And we've got to do a better job at that.
I want to I'm going to do a little bit of a kind of a quick switch here because so again I want people to know that there are folks out there who we haven't heard about, right? So we mentioned William Still earlier. So I just started off the top of my head, out of my little brain. I just first person I came up with for some reason was Carl Stokes, who was the first African-American mayor of a large city, which was Cleveland, Ohio, by the way. And he was before Tom Bradley, who was the mayor of L.A., who's still those at least in L.A., he's still the only black mayor they've ever had. And the airport is actually named after him, LAX. Shirley Chisholm, who is just a marvel who we never talk about. She was the first black woman to run for president. And this is in the 70s.
Unbossed, that was her tag.
She, I mean, just a force of nature, man. And just totally, history doesn't revere her enough, in my estimation, considering what she was up against.
And a congressperson
as right.
well.
A serving Congress.
Congressperson.
Maynard Jackson, he was the first black mayor of Atlanta. Dr. Charles Drew, the whole world owes a debt to him for creating what we now know as blood plasma and other medical uses for blood. Paul Laurence Dunbar is a famous poet. They named high schools after that dude. Langston Hughes. Everybody should read Langston Hughes.
Yeah.
Your life will be better for it. James Baldwin, one of the smartest people you will ever come across. YouTube, James Baldwin on Merv Griffin. People, he will knock your socks off. Let's see, Madam C.J. Walker, first black millionaire, female millionaire, and Fannie Lou Hamer. You know, there's just so many people that.
Let's throw in Katherine Johnson. You watch the movie Hidden Figures.
Right?
Mm-hmm. So, well, and how about if we name some of those that are local? Emma Houston, for example, who is currently one of the highest level African-American in Salt Lake County.
Yes.
Shauna Graves Robinson.
Judge.
Who is a judge and a presiding judge. Gladys Hessler, who was a social worker back in the day, after rearing her own children, became a social worker. Kathleen Christie, who rose to be assistant superintendent of Salt Lake City Schools. Sandra Hollins, as I mentioned earlier, who is the only African-American in the state legislature and a woman
so
as
hard.
Well as black.
The reason we have Juneteenth Day is largely because of her efforts today. In Utah, there is recognized Juneteenth as a state recognized day.
And Betty Sawyer had a lot to do with
absolutely.
That.
And how about Judge Tyrone Medley, first
Judge
black?
Judge Tyrone Medley is retired, but was a third district court judge and played basketball here, mm-hmm. went to law school here. Significant contributions, and yet we don't even know his name.
When we come back, we're going to kind of close this out and offer people some opportunities to find where they might be able to find more about these kinds of wonderful people who have great stories to tell and who have helped shape our state and our nation throughout history. You're listening to Voices of Reason. Welcome back to Voices of Reason. I am Jason Lee, along with Amy Donaldson. Today, we're speaking with Reverend France Davis and Adrian Andrews, who is the Chief Diversity Officer and Assistant Vice President for Diversity at Weber State University. Reverend Davis is a local historian who kind of reminded me that we left out some people just locally because we think of when we as living in Salt Lake mostly, we often think about this is kind of where the center of the universe for Utah is, and certainly black Utah, but that's not really true.
Adrian's laughing.
Because Adrian, who is, you grew up in Ogden, right?
I actually grew up in Layton, but my father was born and raised in Ogden. My grandmother, Betty Gillespie, was raised in Ogden. She was born in Texas, raised in Ogden. Her father came here with the railroad. And
which is why, isn't that how a lot of African Americans settled here in Utah?
Oh, a lot of them came. They came both to, they came to three places, Ogden, Helper, Price, and Salt Lake City.
Oh, that's right. Price
and
had,
in those three areas, it was railroad-centered that brought large numbers of African Americans here.
As well as Hill Air Force Base, as well as
military
installations. So, for example, my grandfather, James Gillespie Sr., came here from Starksville, Mississippi, during the military, his military duty in the 40s.
Mississippi State is there, right?
That's correct. Yeah. And he came here and decided to stay when his tour was complete. And his extended family, which was very large, said, "Why are you staying in Utah?" And he said, "If not me, who?" And there was already a community, a small community of African Americans here that he ended up having the opportunity to work with and help flourish and integrate into the community. He ended up being the president of the NAACP for over 33 years. And his wife, Betty, ended up being an early high school graduate who went to Howard University in Washington, D.C., mm-hmm. came back and completed a tremendous career at Hill Air Force Base working with Equal Opportunity and Affirmative Action. My own father, James Gillespie Jr., worked in law enforcement here in Ogden, Utah. Of course, Marshall White was the first black police officer in Ogden, Utah. And he was able to have a fantastic career as well in law enforcement and corrections here in the state. But then let's think about other folks. We can think about Darnell Haney, who was a dean at Weber College at the time.
Mm-hmm. Still alive.
Still alive.
And active artist.
An amazing artist. And in fact, about a month and a half ago, he gave me a painting of Dr. King for my office, and his granddaughter brought it to me. And it's fantastic. He is still in our community, very active, engaged in the arts community, a recent recipient of the Ogden Mayor's Award for his artwork. We can look at Alicia Washington and her sister Camille Washington. These two sisters are phenomenal individuals and the founders and operators of Good Company Theater in Ogden, a theater company that focuses on plays and performance pieces about underrepresented audiences, and they spent the last year bringing incredible shows to our community. Dee Dee Darby Duffin, who is here in Salt Lake, but I think of her wherever I am because I was a contemporary of hers in college at the University of Utah, and she's coming to Ogden to perform and do works there. There are all of these amazing people, including one of my mentors and truly an incredible friend, Dr. Forrest Crawford, yep. who has been an individual who has spearheaded work in all avenues of social justice, whether it is with race, class, gender, ethnicity,
for
disability
services.
How many years
has Dr. Crawford been around?
He has been at Weber for over 40 years. And he came as a football player from Oklahoma and has made Utah his second home. And Utah would not be where it is today without his leadership,
Absolutely.
Without his ability to build relationships and bridges and to guide people on how to be inclusive in history and in education. And as a teacher educator, because that's what his doctoral work is in, mm-hmm. He is able to help transform the next generation of educators coming up into our schools. But it takes all of us, not just one of us. And it requires that we recognize and validate the work of all of these people and not just one or two of these people.
Plus we recently from Ogden was Joe McQueen, who yeah. was funeralized at 100 years old. And just a few weeks ago that happened.
He was
an
amazing
musician. He happened to
have
been here as a musician. He continued to play until his last moment.
Right.
And he played with some of the significant national figures.
Absolutely.
Dizzy Gillespie and people like that. Also,
he had a Lucille, by the way.
Yeah.
B.B.
Yeah.
King gave him one of his guitars. That guy, right. He was something else.
Also, one of the things that we haven't mentioned very much is the legislative impact that African Americans have had. Reverend Robert Harris from Ogden was the first African American legislator in the Utah State Legislature. Terry Williams.
Who also took me to barbecue when I went to interview him. He said, "You got to come to Ogden and hang out with me if you want to interview me."
Terry Williams was the first black senator in the Utah State Legislature. James Evans followed later on.
Yeah. Dwayne Bourdeau?
Dwayne Bourdeau was in the legislature for many years.
Absolutely.
You know, we just have a lot of people that have made significant contributions, and yet we don't know very much about that.
So we only got like a couple of minutes left to go. I just want to.
I can't let this opportunity pass. And I thought about writing this down in a card, and I thought I think the world should hear this because we don't. I agree with everything that's been said today. We don't know enough. We don't engage enough. And I go to like when I go to an African American film. And I'm one of the few white people there. It makes me so sad. And I would just say that you're just missing out, especially we've talked about the artists. If you haven't listened to the music or read the poems or read the stories of these people, you're just your life will be so much richer. And that's really my desire for diversity is there's just so much to learn and so many things to draw from in these experiences. But I just have this little quick letter. I promise I'll be fast. Dear Reverend Davis, and I'll probably get emotional, but I'll try not to. I wanted to take a few minutes and let you know how grateful I am for your generosity of spirit. I'm also grateful for your time, your patience, your words of wisdom, your beautiful example of tireless love. But mostly, I am grateful that you have been so generous spiritually. Your willingness to help me, especially as an idealistic rookie reporter whose only exposure to African Americans was through books. I wanted to let you know you have been an invaluable teacher and mentor for me in understanding how important it is to represent people in all varieties of their experience, all varieties and textures of their experience authentically. It has allowed me to see beauty and feel joy when others in my profession saw disadvantage and felt pity. It has allowed me to find teachers and lessons in places I never expected. Instead of using my position in the media to help them, they have used their stories to enlighten and change me. You are a living example of Christ's commandment that we love one another. And I would add that your ability to take tough issues and fight some pretty discouraging problems with love has shaped the kind of activist I have tried to be. You have taught me so much, and I thank you from the bottom of my heart for your time, your insights, your honest and unflagging help, and example of how love transforms the giver before it ever changes the recipients.
And I taught at the university African American Studies, where lots of people were exposed to the positive achievements that African Americans have made for many years. Retired about 5 years ago from that task. But we need more people who, from an education point of view, from a political point of view, from an economic point of view, from a social point of view, to point out that African Americans are an integral contribution to this society.
That black history is U.S. history.
It's
our history.
Absolutely.
Correct.
I want to say thank you to you both. I was really excited. I know Amy was yesterday when we were able to kind of confirm everything was going to be happening. And I'm so grateful that you were able to join us today. I want to say thank you to Dr. Davis and to Adrian for joining us today. And join us again for the next episode of the Loudmouth Project's Voices of Reason. If you have comments about our show, please contact us via email at vorjamed@gmail.com or at vorjasonl@gmail. You can also find us on Twitter at @AD on Sports and @JasonLee1. Our show's Twitter handle is @VOR Podcast. Check out our Facebook page. And you can also find and subscribe to free episodes of our podcast on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, or other places where you find interesting content. Be sure to review our show as well. We love to get your feedback, and it helps us grow our audience. Until next time, I'm Jason Lee. When you engage in passionate debate, do your best to keep your dialogue civil. Try to be the voice of reason.
Voices of Reason is a production of the Loudmouth Project.